And welcome to
Killing It
on Broadway. I'm Jennifer Simard.
And I'm Jessica Vosk. And this is the podcast where we discuss all things guts, gore, murder, and mayhem.
It's not safe for work. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, Jennifer.
And hi, Danielle Wade.
Hello.
Danny, hey girl.
Do you want us to say Danny or Danielle? Because you know I know you go by both.
I do. Whatever you'd like, I'll answer.
I'm feeling a Danny Wade mood.
Yeah. Go for it. Do it.
Today you're Danny. Danny with an I. Well, we're so excited to have you here today, Danny. We've had two requests of late for this very case that we're doing today from some of our Canadian fans. So we thought, who better to join us than Canadian theatrical star Danielle Wade. You won the role of Dorothy. She's laughing. You won the role of Dorothy in the Canadian TV series Over the Rainbow, and most recently starred as Katie Heron in the first national tour of Mean Girls. Hey, holla, our Mean Girls fam. But despite these amazing accomplishments and many more, we don't want to talk about your career today whatsoever.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Can I also just say something? Mm-hmm. I just want to make a confession.
Uh-oh.
And that is this. When Jen was like, we have a couple requests for this person. And I was like, what celebrity is that?
I said Paul Bernardo. She thought I wanted him to be a guest on the show.
And I was like, who is, like, I've never heard about, like, I don't mean to be weird and rude about it. And she was like, yeah, so he's a murderer. Like, I don't.
Oops. Understand.
And so now I'm going to crawl into my turtle shell and, admit that to everybody listening and apologize to Canada because I didn't know, but now I know. And so that. Know.
And also Danny just gave a thumbs up, by the way. How humble is she when we say we're not going to talk about her career? Big thumbs up.
Well, she says, I'm a star. I won a competition. The world knows I'm a genius. Mm-hmm. I'm talented AF, but guess what? I also like murder.
I love murder.
See, she just whispered it back. It's a call and response to all of our killers out there. Whenever we ask you guys and gals who loves true crime, you can all go,
me.
And that's my Delilah radio voice, but murderous.
And to be clear, we all hate it, really. I mean, no one likes true crime, but we are fascinated by it, right? Is that
absolutely
an agreement, right?
Political, yes. To be super on, yes, that's... It's a fascination station that I use the word love for, but what I mean by love is I'm disgusted by it.
Did I politically correct? She policed you. I'm sorry.
She policed me.
I didn't mean to.
No, it's okay. It's okay. I'll call equity. But it's a love of the knowledge of what's going on because I also feel like at any time we can be lawyers based on all the information we know. Right. About every case that we dive into, which me, it's like a daily basis. I pick up my phone and I'm like, what is new today, kids? What can I be a lawyer for here? And so that's how I tend to live my life now, which is a love-hate relationship with true crime.
Oh, can I also, Danny, do you mind if we took a picture just for the Insta story, even though we're not made up? We three all love a top knotty situation. So I'm going to take a picture of our top knotties. Everyone... Just give me your top naughty. All right. Thanks, ladies.
Thank you very much. All Jen and I discuss, as we've talked about, is true crime. This particular case is friggin' huge. And for that reason, we're going to get right to it because our listeners are probably chomping at the bit to understand this case as well. So, Danny, how and why are you interested in true crime? And what fascinates you the most? Spill.
I mean, the whole thing. Like, I, like we said, I don't love it. I say I love it, but by that I mean I'm just totally fascinated by it. And I don't understand how people's brains work like that. And I think I'm like trying to figure out how you could ever possibly have these ideas. I think that is fascinating to me. My middle sister, I have two younger ones. We used to watch a lot of crime shows because they were on right after school. And if you're homesick in Canada, they're on all day. And you can watch reruns and reruns of CSI or Criminal Minds. And you just understand human behavior a little bit more. I think it's helpful to us, too.
As actors or as people?
Both. Mm-hmm. Like, as both. You kind of understand people a little bit more. And you can be like, well, they're doing the best they can. Or they're not.
You know, like, or they were like, you used the wrong fork. Boom. You know what I mean?
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. It does make sense. And no offense to the psychologists and psychiatrists out there, but to your point that this is good for us as actors to delve into the psychology of people, we couldn't agree more. While we're not that, we are. We have to be that as actors, right? But we are on this show. We're experts of everything. We're experts to the point that we call ourselves doctors. This is Dr. Vosk. I'm Dr. Samard. And while we love your last name, I think today we're going to do some alliteration. We're going to call you Dr. Danny.
Well, thank you. Thank you for my degree. Right. I can't wait.
Okay. Thank you. Danny's laughing. Dr. Danny, thank you. So, okay, moving on. As we said, this case and your homeland, oh, Canada, was requested. You are from Canada, correct? Whereabouts?
I am from like a little town in southern Ontario called LaSalle, Ontario. It's like, I would say 4 hours from where all of this happened.
All right. We are so grateful that you are here as a Canadian local. So we're going to dive in. But first, credit where credit is due. As we always say, we got our information today from our forever love, Wikipedia. And honestly, your trigger warning, dear listeners, is now. Now through the end, because it's all awful. All of it. Whew, here we go. This is the case of the Ken and Barbie killers. Paul Kenneth Bernardo was born August 27th, 1964. In his early life, Paul had some things to deal with, namely, his father, Kenneth, was accused of fondling a girl and was charged with child molestation in 1975. And he also sexually abused his daughter, presumably Paul's sister, but wait, more on that in a tick. But yeah, Jess is shaking her head. It's coming. Don't worry. Yeah. Now, Bernardo's mother was depressed about her husband's abuse. She withdrew from family life and lived in the basement of their home in Scarborough. So she was quarantining before it was a thing. This was in Eastern Metropolitan Toronto. Now, as a youth, Paul Bernardo reportedly had a charming facade, but beneath the charming facade, he had developed dark sexual fantasies and enjoyed humiliating women in public and beating women he dated. When Paul was 16, his mother told him that he was conceived illegitimately during an extramarital affair. So the sister I mentioned earlier is presumably his biological half-sister, we're guessing. Disgusted, Paul began openly insulting his mother. And as Jess is always so fond of pointing out, it's something to do with the mothers, I think, in all of these cases and all of these guys, right?
Hello. Yeah. Hello.
Every single one.
Always. Always. The point I always try to make as a doctor of brain.
Danny's nodding and her top knot is like a bobblehead doll. Yeah,
it's so big. Okay. I'm so sorry. I should have prepped.
No, don't be. Why? No one's going to see this other than the picture.
First of all, we apologize far too much as women. I hate
also
to now,
the Canadian in me too.
Of course. But you know what? While you might feel bad that the top knot is large and in charge, we like it, and
thank
we prefer you.
You
to be a bobblehead of emotion.
Thank
and
you.
And we want to tell our listeners that that's how we're getting our emotional cues from Danny today is based on her movement of the top knot. Okay. And if
that's
you
right.
all want to have fun, okay, have fun.
And real quick, Danny, I want to say I too apologize a lot. I happen to love the apology because to me, it's polite. It's like, thank you, please. It's like, please and thank you to me. Sometimes.
It's just
that's
so common.
I mean
it's so common where I grow up. Like, that's where I've grown up. Just. Innately,
maybe that's where I get it from, because my family's French Canadian, so maybe that's a holdover
so
from that. I don't know.
It's a joke. Like, it's honestly a joke that Canadians apologize so much, but man, oh man, do they. Like, they really, really
reason,
ring true.
To that end, I would like to invite you to come live in New Jersey. Because it's a special time here, and you will not have that here.
No one will. Well, then,
you know. And that's, although I believe in the I'm sorry, I'm, you know, Jen and I, we always talk about this. I go, don't you apologize? Don't you apologize, Mira.
I need to do it more, though. I need to do that to myself more.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Because you know what? A top knot is nothing to apologize for, even if it's a little out of control.
I think we're going to rename this episode The Top Knot because we've spent more time on a top knot
talking
than
about a
Paul Bernardo, the serial killer top knot. All right. Now let's move on. Paul attended Sir Wilfrid Laurier Collegiate Institute. Did I say that right, Danny?
Correct. Okay. Very correct.
Paul, Okay. He attended this institute in Scarborough and then went to University of Toronto Scarborough in 1982 and worked for Amway, whose sales culture deeply affected him. Quote, he bought the books and tapes of famous motivational get rich and famous experts, end quote. Paul and his friends practiced pickup techniques on young women they met in bars and were fairly successful. It was in October 1987 where he met Carla Homolka, and they were sexually attracted to each other almost immediately. Unlike the other women he knew, she encouraged his sadistic sexual behavior. Such a supportive girlfriend. Paul was keenly interested in the 1991 Bret Easton Ellis novel, American Psycho, and, quote, read it as his Bible, which would be about 100 red flags right there, just in one.
Yeah. Yeah. As somebody who finds red flags easily, that one is a ding ding SOS. So now we're heading into 1990, right? Paul is spending very long periods of time with Carla's family, who actually liked him. And although he was engaged to Carla, what did he do, y'all? He flirted with her younger sister, Tammy. And Paul had not told them that he had lost his job as an accountant and was smuggling cigarettes across a nearby, the nearby, Canada-United States border. And he had become pretty obsessed with Tammy, and he would peer into her window and he'd enter her room, and he would do things like masturbate when she slept, which is also special. And Carla helped Paul by breaking the windows in her sister's room, allowing him access. So we call Carla an enabler, but it seems to be more than that. She seems to also be sadistic. So in July, he took Tammy across the border to get beer for a party. And Paul later told his fiancée that, quote, they got drunk and began making out. And so according to Paul's testimony at his trial, Carla, let's give her the title of Sister of the Year, honey, laced some spaghetti sauce with some crushed Valium she'd stolen from her employer at Martindale Animal Clinic. Now, she served it to her sister, who soon lost consciousness. And Paul then raped Tammy while Carla watched. And Tammy woke up after 1 minute. And over the summer, he supplied Tammy and her friends with gifts, food, and soft drinks with, quote, a film and a few white flecks on the top. So 6 months before their 1991 wedding, they still got married, y'all. This is the real kicker here. Carla stole the anesthetic agent halothane from the clinic. And on December 23rd of 1990, Carla and Paul administered sleeping pills to the 15-year-old in a rum and eggnog cocktail. When Tammy lost consciousness, Carla and Paul undressed her, and Carla applied a halothane-soaked cloth to her sister's nose and mouth. Carla wanted to, quote, give Tammy's virginity to Paul for Christmas. And according to her, Paul was disappointed that he was not Carla's first sex partner. I mean, this is...
Hey, Jess.
Go ahead, Jen. Yes, ma'am.
May I ask Danny about it, actually?
Yes.
Because this confused me in the story. It confused me that Carla's saying she wanted to give her sister's virginity to Paul as a Christmas present. But we just heard that he already had raped her in the summer and Carla had watched. So is this the second time in our time? Because our timeline indicates this is the second time, but that she's not a virgin anymore if he raped her in the summer. So I don't understand. Is it just a part two of the same thing? I don't understand.
I always struggled with that too, because there's a bunch of different versions, and I think it is the second time. I mean, that's what I understood when I was told it, but that also doesn't make sense because.
Or did she wake up when it says that she woke up into,
really fast? Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Maybe that didn't happen.
Because then he was trying to play it off. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think the full thing happened the first time, if that makes sense.
Dr. Vosk, thank you. We're going to hang your degree right behind your desk. Thank you.
And I want you to know that I will accept it. And that's what I'm assuming this is, because I'm assuming she's like, and you know what, this is going to be a huge Christmas gift for you. You know, like, let's take, you know, we don't need a nativity. Let's take it down and let's just have this be your Christmas present, because she's a fucking psycho. Anyway. So with Tammy's parents sleeping upstairs, they videotaped themselves raping her in the basement. Tammy began to vomit, and they tried to revive her and called 911 after hiding evidence, dressing Tammy, and moving her into her bedroom. And so a few hours later, Tammy was pronounced dead at St. Catherine's General Hospital without regaining consciousness. So now, despite their behavior, which was vacuuming and washing laundry in the middle of the night, and despite a chemical burn on Tammy's face, the Homolka family accepted Paul and Carla's version of the events. Because honestly, what parent would actually want to believe what happened? You know, no parent would want to believe that. So the official cause of Tammy Homolka's death was accidental. Choking on vomit after consumption of alcohol. So Paul and Carla subsequently videotaped themselves with Carla wearing Tammy's clothing and pretending to be her. And they moved out of the Homolka house to a rented Port Dalhousie. How do we say that, Danny?
Yeah, that's it.
Get out.
Yeah.
Oh my God. First try. SOS. Port Dalhousie. So they moved out of the Homolka house to a rented Port Dalhousie bungalow to allow Homolka's parents to grieve.
Ooh. Danny, before I continue, you looked like you wanted to say something. Do you remember?
Yeah. Like, wouldn't you just be like a little suspicious though?
The parents? I'm sure.
Yeah. Like, apparently Tammy was like a really good girl too. Like she wasn't like a partier. I mean, with Paul and Carla, but like, wouldn't you be a little suspicious when there's like a chemical burn on your face?
Oh, yeah. I would also say that there's probably a lot of suspicion happening, but I think denial is a very strong.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, moment in a lot of parents' brains of like, this couldn't possibly have happened. Like, if we have to believe that this happened, then that makes our other daughter a monster.
Yeah. Yeah. Why would you want to agree?
Yeah, I'm so close with my brothers. I love them both. I cannot imagine that kind of betrayal. I cannot imagine it.
Oh, God. It's really disgusting.
And she's a kid. It's really like, disgusting. She's young.
Yeah. She's like 15.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm there completely. Yeah.
All right. So moving on. On June 7th, 1991, Homolka invited a 15-year-old girl she had befriended at a pet shop 2 years earlier, known as Jane Doe, in the trials for a, quote, girl's night out. After an evening of shopping and dining, Carla plied Jane Doe with alcohol laced with Halzin. When the girl lost consciousness, Carla called Paul to tell him that his surprise wedding gift was ready. Paul videotaped Carla raping the girl before he himself sexually assaulted her. The next morning, Jane Doe was nauseated but thought that her vomiting was from drinking alcohol for the first time and did not realize that she had been sexually assaulted. Mm. In August, Jane Doe was invited back to Port Dalhousie to, quote, spend the night and was again drugged. Carla called 911 for help after the girl stopped breathing while being raped. Carla called back a few minutes later to say that, quote, everything is all right, and the ambulance was recalled without follow-up. Jane Doe survived.
Thank God.
There's an interesting fact about Jane Doe is that she went to the wedding still. Allegedly, she went to their wedding because she didn't know.
That poor woman.
Mm-mm. I know. That's crazy.
This is a film.
Thank you, Dr. Danny. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. D.
Anytime.
So early in the morning on June 15th of 1991, Paul detoured through Burlington, which is halfway between Toronto and St. Catharines, to steal license plates and found Leslie Mahaffey. The 14-year-old had missed her curfew after attending a friend's wake and was locked out of her house. Now, Paul left his car and approached Mahaffey, saying that he wanted to break into a neighbor's house. Unfazed, she asked if he had any cigarettes. And when Paul led her to his car, he blindfolded her, forced her into the car, drove her to Port Dalhousie, and informed Carla that they had a victim. Paul and Carla yet again videotaped themselves torturing and sexually abusing Mahaffey while they listened to Bob Marley and David Bowie. And at one point, Paul said, quote, you're doing a good job, Leslie, a damned good job, adding, quote, the next 2 hours are going to determine what I do to you. Right now, you're scoring perfect. On another segment of tape played at Paul's trial, the assault escalated, and you can go look up those details because not at this time are we going to discuss them. So Mahaffey later told Paul that her blindfold seemed to be slipping, which did signal the possibility that she could identify her attackers if she lived. The following day, Paul claimed Carla fed her a lethal dose of Halzin. Carla claimed that Bernardo strangled her, and they put Mahaffey's body in their basement. And the day after that, Carla's family had dinner at the house. Can you please pass the salt? Danny's upset. She had a moment. I know you all can't see it, but we did, and it was not And after the Homolkas and their remaining daughter, Lori, left, Paul and Carla decided that the best way to dispose of the evidence would be to dismember Mahaffey and encase each part of her remains in cement, which, like, of course, and we've had other episodes where killers have done this. So, I mean, honestly, it's that brain thing that we talk about. Where do you get this shit? Now, Paul bought a dozen bags of cement at a hardware store the following day. Fun fact, he kept the receipts, which were very damaging at his trial. Thanks, Paul. Now, Paul used his grandfather's circular saw to dismember Mahaffey, and Paul and Carla made a number of trips to dump the cement blocks in Lake Gibson. At least one of the blocks weighed 200 pounds and was beyond their ability to sink. It laid near the shore where it was found by Michael Doucette and his son Michael Jr. while on a fishing expedition on June 29, 1991. Mahaffey's orthodontic appliance was instrumental in identifying her. So later, when Paul was interviewed by police and his lawyer, Tony Bryant, according to Bryant, Paul said that he had always intended to free the girls that he and Carla kidnapped. However, when Mahaffey's blindfold fell off, allowing her to see his face, Carla was very concerned that Mahaffey would identify Paul and report him to the police. Paul claimed that Carla planned to murder Mahaffey by injecting an air bubble into her bloodstream, triggering an air embolism.
Isn't that, incredibly painful?
Yes! I don't know, but yes.
All right, moving on to the next phase of this horrible story. During the after-school hours of April 16th, 1992, Paul and Carla drove through St. Catharines to look for potential victims. And this is the part of the movie Carla that I saw that taught me never to come close to a car. Danny, weren't you telling us you had training in this at school? Can you elaborate on that?
They talk about it at school. Like, even though it was long before I was, like, in high school and able to drive and all the things, they're like, when if someone stops and asks you for directions, you stay far away. You don't go up to their car and tell them where to go. You stay as far away as possible, because here is why. And they did it a bunch of times, right? She's the most, like, reported version, but they tried a million times. So you don't go near the car is the number one rule in school.
Amen. Wow.
Thank you for sharing that personal experience as a local, training that children got because of what these two did. All right. So in this period we've been discussing, this is also known as the schoolgirl killings, because that was kind of their target at this point.
Oh, my God.
Although the students were still going home, the streets were generally empty. As Paul and Carla passed Holy Cross Secondary School, a Catholic high school in the city's north end, they spotted 15-year-old Kristen French walking briskly to her nearby home. They pulled into the parking lot of nearby Grace Lutheran Church, and Carla got out of the car, map in hand, pretending to need assistance. When Kristen looked at the map, Paul attacked her from behind, brandishing a knife and forcing her into the front seat of their car. From the back seat, Carla subdued Kristen by pulling her hair. Now, Kristen took the same route home every day. Wait, because this is a Canadian guest. Do you guys say route or route? What do you say?
Oh, I would say route. Same route home, route? Same route home.
What are you talking about?
It's the same with Dalhousie and Dalhousie. Like, people regionally will say it differently. Yeah, I would say route.
Route? Well, we're going to do it your way. Here we go. Yeah, so this poor young woman had her whole life ahead of her. She takes the same route home every day, which took about 15 minutes to get home and care for her dog. Soon after she should have arrived, her parents became convinced that she met with foul play and notified the police. Within 24 hours, the Niagara Regional Police Service assembled a team, searched Kristen's route, and found several witnesses who had seen the abduction from different locations, giving police a fairly clear picture. Kristen's shoe, recovered from the parking lot, underscored the seriousness of the abduction. Over the Easter weekend, Paul and Carla videotaped themselves torturing, raping, and sodomizing Kristen, forcing her to drink large amounts of alcohol and submit to Paul. At his trial, Crown Prosecutor Hay Houlihan said that Paul always intended to kill her because she was never blindfolded and could identify her captors. The following day, Paul and Carla murdered Kristen before going to the Homolkas for Easter dinner. Kristen's nude body was found on April 30th, 1992, in a ditch in Burlington, about 45 minutes from St. Catharines and a short distance from the cemetery where Mahaffey is buried. She had been washed and her hair was cut off. Although it was thought that French's hair was removed as a trophy, Carla testified that it was cut to impede identification. It's horrible.
Disgusting. Now, We do have to go back in time here to make something very clear. So on March 29th, 1992, 1 month prior to this particular incident, Paul stalked and videotaped two sisters from his car and followed them to their parents' house. Now, the sisters incorrectly recorded his license plate number, and one sister reported the incident, very good for you, girl, and on March 31st, 1992, received an incident number to report further information. So fast forward a month, back to our Kristen French kidnapping before she was brutally murdered. Now, on April 18th, 1992, Carla was guarding Kristen while Paul went out to buy dinner and rent a movie. While he was out, he was spotted by one of the sisters who attempted to track him to his house. Although she lost him, she got a better description of his license plate and car and reported them to police. Now, this is like such a two thumbs up amazing moment. But not so amazing, though, is that her information was mishandled by police, falling into a black hole. And later, there was an inquiry into police mishandling of evidence in the case.
You think?
And my thing here is, like, I'm just going to say, I will bet you $1 million Monopoly dollars that they were like, oh, it's just a young girl. You know what I mean? Like, it fell by the wayside. She's a young girl. Who knows if it's really a thing or not? And nobody followed up on it. That's my take on this. And that really chaps my ass.
Well, because part of it, too, is if they had, people would not have been hurt. Which is like, why wouldn't you just do it? Go, yes, it's manpower and all the things, but obviously she's distressed. Go investigate.
Like, follow up, kids. So now we're at the point where Carla and Paul were questioned by police several times in connection with the Scarborough rapist investigation, Tammy Homolka's death, and Paul's stalking of other women before the death of French. And the officers decided that he was an unlikely suspect, although Paul admitted that he had been questioned in connection with the Scarborough rapes. 3 days later, the Green Ribbon Task Force was created to investigate the murders of Mahaffey and French. Paul and Carla, meanwhile, had applied to have their names legally changed to Teal, which Paul had taken from the serial killer in the 1988 film Criminal Law. Okay. And at the end of May of 1992, John Motile, an acquaintance of Paul's, reported him as a possible murder suspect. Thank you, John. And in December of 1992, the Center of Forensic Sciences finally began testing DNA samples. Now, we always say this here at the KIOB, #BlessDNA, because we're in the 90s and most of the cases that we have covered have taken place 60s, 70s, early 80s. And some of them, those that were solved, thank God, Jesus, were solved because of DNA. And the advent of these new databases and the capabilities of DNA. So thank goodness this took place in the 90s, where DNA was already in existence. So #BlessDNA. And they tested the DNA samples provided by Paul 2 years earlier.
Now, we have here an important parallel track this same month that led to all of this unraveling. On December 27th, 1992, Paul severely beat Carla on the limbs, head, and face with a flashlight. Ugh. Yeah. Jess is upset. I know, Jess.
I'm That's upset. Awful. You know, it makes me...
Right.
I have a... So, this really so chaps me.
Right. So he's turned on his wife here, right? Claiming that she had been in an automobile accident, the severely bruised Carla returned to work on January 4th, 1993. Her skeptical coworkers called her parents, and although they rescued her the following day by physically removing her from the house, Carla went back in frantically searching for something. Her parents took her to St. Catherine's General Hospital, where she gave a statement that she was a battered spouse and filed charges against Paul. He was arrested and later released on his own recognizance. And finally, dear listeners, we do have an arrest. 26 months after Paul submitted a DNA sample, Toronto police were informed that it matched that of the Scarborough rapist and immediately placed him under 24-hour surveillance. Metro Toronto Sexual Assault Squad investigators interviewed Carla on February 9, 1993. Despite hearing their suspicions about Paul, Carla focused on his abuse of her. Later that night, she told her aunt and uncle that Paul was the Scarborough rapist, that she and Paul were involved in the rape and murder of Mahaffey and French. Now, I didn't read any mention of her poor sister. That's not mentioned here.
She was ruled as an accident.
Right. That's a very good point. Her sister Tammy's death was ruled an accident. And I guess it just goes to, I don't think I'm alone here in saying that, in the words of Jessica Vosk, Carla really chaps my ass. Like I...
An ass chapper?
No, she could not. And
well, it gets worse, so get ready.
It gets worse. It gets worse.
Killing It on Broadway is proud to support A-STEP, Artists Striving to End Poverty. This organization was started by our friend Mary Mitchell Campbell, musical director of Broadway and beyond, who also wrote our theme song,
As we all know, the arts are in a challenging time right now in the U.S., and A-STEP has been doing innovative things during this pandemic, including feeding thousands of families, as well as bringing the arts to children. If you are able, please go to astep.org to make a contribution to the Arts Resilience Fund so they can keep killing it by bringing smiles to the faces of children everywhere.
That's astep.org. Thanks, killers.
Let's move on. So she's coming clean to her aunt and uncle that she and Paul were involved in the rape and murder of Mahaffey and French. Now the NPR the NRP reopened its investigation of Tammy Homolka's death. Thank God. 2 days later, Carla met with Niagara Falls lawyer George Walker, who sought legal immunity from Houlihan in exchange for her cooperation. She was also placed under 24-hour surveillance. The couple's name change was approved on February 13th, 1993. Who cares? The next day, Walker met with Crown Criminal Law Office Director Maury Siegel. After Walker told Siegel about the videotapes of the rapes, Siegel advised him that due to Carla's involvement in the crimes, full immunity was not a possibility. Abso-frickin-tootly, as Jess would say, or something like that. You say stuff like that all the time. So I had to say, I had to give you a little props there. That's so right. On February 17th, Metro Sexual Assault Squad and Green Ribbon Task Force detectives arrested Paul Bernardo on several charges and obtained a search warrant. Because his link to the murders was weak, the warrant was limited. No evidence, which was not expected and documented in the warrant, could be removed from the premises, and all videotapes found by police had to be viewed in the house. Damage had to be kept to a minimum. Police could not tear down walls looking for videotapes. The search of the house, including updated warrants, lasted 71 days, and the only tape found by police had a brief segment of Carla performing oral sex on Jane Doe. And we left that in there because I think it's important to remember that Carla is also a serial rapist and killer as well.
That's right. You know? That is right. And you know what? She fucking pisses me off. I'm sorry. Earmuffs.
Yeah. May 5th, I'm like this.
I'm sorry for everybody who is like not watching this right now because we don't film this. Like I'm doing a put 'em up. Like I'm ready to. Like I can't.
We're full cowardly lion.
Oh, Danny brought it back to her time and Wizard of Oz.
It's hard because clearly Carla has also been beaten. Which you do feel bad for her in the her abuse, but also, like, it's apparently clear in all of the tapes that she is there and a part of it.
Yes.
And partial to it.
She has agency, and she made a choice.
Yeah. It's so hard. It's so...
So on May 5th, Walker was informed that the government was offering Carla a plea bargain of 12 years, which she had 1 week to accept. If she declined, the government would charge her with 2 counts of first-degree murder, 1 count of second-degree murder, and other crimes. Walker accepted the offer, and Carla later agreed to it. On May 14th, Carla's plea bargain was finalized, and she began giving statements to police investigators. She told police that Paul boasted that he had raped as many as 30 women, twice as many as the police suspected, calling him, quote, the happy rapist.
That's nice. Well, Paul Bernardo was tried for the murders of French and Mahaffey in 1995, and his trial included detailed testimony from Carla and the videotapes of the rapes. Now, of course, I will say, like, side note here, we talk about this all the time when people are offered these plea bargains. But, I mean, I would say that's a pretty damn good plea deal and plea bargain that she entered herself into. So knowing that, naturally, she's going to give up all this information about Paul, which to this point, Paul testifies that the deaths were accidental, later claiming that his wife was the actual killer. Yeah, that surprises me so much that he did that.
Shocking, yeah, exactly. That he blamed her. What do you mean?
Narcissists. psychopath blames his wife.
Yeah, I mean, that he
not,
beats.
She did some shit. Yeah, I mean, she's not
she's
well.
There. She's not well, but she also, like, it's, that's where the fine line of, like, she is not well. They did it. This is an interesting fact. They did, like, a psychotherapy test on both of them mm-hmm. when they were incarcerated. Do you know about this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but go ahead. You go.
Paul rated, like, 30 or 35 out of 40, and she was 5 out of 40.
Whoa. Hmm.
But also, well, like, does that mean she tricked them all? Is she more of a psychopath? Or was she really not a part of, like, how do you, is she crazier and tricked them all?
Oh, you mean tricked the people giving the test. Well, let's talk about that more when we get to that section.
Now, we talked about how Paul testifies that the deaths were accidental and he blames it on Carla, naturally. So on September 1st of 1995, Paul was convicted of a number of offenses, including the 2 first-degree murders and 2 aggravated sexual assaults, and sentenced to life in prison without parole for at least 25 years.
Goodbye.
But also not enough. But anyway, whatever. He was designated a dangerous offender, making him unlikely to ever be released, thank God. Now, in a plea bargain, which is a 12-year sentence for manslaughter, this is utter horseshit. Amen. Carla testified against Paul in his murder trial. And the plea bargain was criticized by many Canadians since Paul's first defense lawyer, Ken Murray, withheld videotapes for 17 months. Now, these were considered crucial evidence, and prosecutors said they would never have agreed to the plea bargain if they had seen the tapes. Murray was later acquitted of obstruction of justice and faced a disciplinary hearing by the Law Society of Upper Canada. Now, although Paul was kept in the segregation unit at Kingston Penitentiary for his own safety, oh, poor Paul, he was attacked and harassed. He was punched in the face by another inmate when he returned from a shower in 1996. And in June 1999, 5 convicts tried to storm his segregation range, and a riot squad used gas to disperse them. But I have to say, what do we all hear about the guys that go to jail for raping minors and assaulting? They're the worst.
They have the worst time.
They have the worst time because everybody is like, let's kill these psychos. Anyway, I digress. But the Toronto Star reported on February 21st of 2006 that Paul admitted sexually assaulting at least 10 other women in attacks not previously attributed to him. Most were in 1986, a year before what police called the Reign of Terror by the Scarborough Rapist. Authorities suspected Paul Bernardo in other crimes, including a string of rapes in Amherst, New York, and the drowning of Terry Anderson in St. Catharines, but he has never acknowledged his involvement. And Paul's lawyer, Anthony G. Bryant, reportedly forwarded the information to legal authorities in November 2005. In 2006, Bernardo gave a prison interview suggesting that he had reformed and would make a good parole candidate. He became eligible to petition a jury. He became eligible to petition a jury to be allowed to apply for early parole in 2008 under the Faint Hope Clause. Since he committed multiple murders before the 1997 Criminal Code Amendment, but he did not do so. Danny, please.
Could you imagine having the gall to have done a crime like this and then think, you know what? I should try and get out. Maybe they'll let me out of here.
I just love that it's called a faint hope clause.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The faintest of hope, my friend.
It made me laugh seeing it in print. Because honestly, it could be us right now in the pandemic. We all have faint hope.
And I always, you know, how about all those people that you've dated where you're like, where either you're like, you see the red flags and you're like, I have the faintest hope though. Like,
but
I mean,
maybe,
that's where this,
maybe one
that's
day.
That's where this phrase exists.
Some of the best advice I ever got in dating was you have to date the person they are, not their potential.
Ooh. Eh. Say it again, Diva.
You have to date or love. You have to love the person they are, not their potential. Choose wisely.
Choose wisely, faintest hope. Don't do the faintest hope clause. So now we're back. And in 2015, Paul became eligible and did apply for day parole in Toronto. Now, according to the victim's lawyer, Tim Danson, not Ted Danson, for anybody who was wondering, it's unlikely that Paul will ever be released from prison because of his dangerous offender status. And in September 2013, he was moved from Kingston Penitentiary, which was closing, to Millhaven Institution in Bath, Ontario, where he is reportedly segregated from the other inmates.
Now, this topic that Danny mentioned earlier fascinates us. here at the KIOB. So everyone, BYOB, because here we go. Paul scored
35. You make me so happy.
Thank you. You like that?
I love it so much.
Every time I say KIOB, I just hear like I hear a beer sound effect.
Yeah.
What's a nice Canadian beer, Danny?
Canadian.
Oh,
or Labatt.
There you go.
Labatt Blue right. is the other
so
one.
Everyone, Labatt just picture Blue. That. So everyone, BYOB, but Paul scored 35 out of 40, which was what Danny was referencing earlier on the psychopathy checklist, which is a psychological assessment tool used to assess the presence of psychopathy in individuals. This is classified, this number, as clinical psychopathy. What I did not know, and what Jess and I did not know in our research, Danny, was that Carla, A, was given the test, and B, scored a 5. So thank you for that. And to your point, can you imagine if she was so brilliant that she could manipulate the test?
That's insane. Clearly, she did all these bad things. It does make you feel bad for her because she's like along for the ride, but a part of it.
I don't feel bad for her.
What if she's so smart?
I do not feel bad for her, Danny. Danny, I do not feel bad for her.
No, I don't feel bad for her. She was punched in the face. That's the only thing. That's the only one. I don't feel bad for her. Just getting right to the to the eyeballs.
Yes. You know what?
No, we agree. We agree.
We absolutely agree. And to your point, though, of what if she beat the system?
Yeah, what if she did?
I say that's an absolute possibility. Why I say this is because let's go back to the very begins with her sister and the situation with her sister. That is a hell of a lot of compartmentalizing. And that's a hell of a lot of manipulating even your own brain and having to do pretty substantial shit to make it okay in your psyche. So I feel like there is, again, Jen and I talk about this all the time. If you were to cut his or her brain open, like that shit's not going to look like our brain, right? There's going to be some weird things in there that's like, you know, the red flags that we didn't see. This like, you know, sense of hope. But I do believe that there's a possibility she could have beat the system. And that's the way I think about it. I'm like, okay, well, she had to compartmentalize all these different things. Dr. Simard?
Yeah, I do have to ask you, ladies, isn't there a part of you as a woman that thinks I could do it? I know how they want me to answer. Part of me suspects that. I'm like, I know how they're going. I know how they want me to answer, and I'm going to answer this way. Like, part of me thinks I could do it. I don't even know what's on the test.
Exactly,
but I feel
right.
But women, I feel like women have this skill, man. I do.
Yes. No, we do. We do. That's my whole point of saying this compartmentalizing thing. But but what you just said about, like, I know what it is that you want to hear. I completely could do that. I completely could do that.
They scored such different numbers.
Right.
Well, and spent like so much time together.
Women are better.
Exactly. You know, like, how was it that big of a difference between two people who committed the same crimes?
True. Very good question. And to be fair, we are on speculation station right now.
Oh,
the facts
are.
All we know, the facts is, according to Dr. Danny, she scored a 5.
Allegedly. So this is what I was understanding.
Oh, okay. Allegedly. We'll be very careful.
Yes.
Allegedly, she scored a 5. So
Put him up.
So in November 2015, Paul self-published A Mad World Order, a violent ebook on Amazon. By November 15th, the book was reportedly an Amazon bestseller, but was removed from the website due to a public outcry. In October 2018, Paul had been set to go to trial for possession of a shank weapon while incarcerated, which in this case was a 5-centimeter long screw attached to a pen. However, the prosecution dropped the charges. Jessica finds that funny. Danny, 5 centimeters, what is that in inches?
Oh, God. But it's very small.
Very teeny.
It's very small.
Look at me just testing your Canadian-American bona fides.
I don't know the conversion.
That's really mean of me.
I should look it up.
That's mean. Someone look it up.
Guys, stop fighting. Guys, stop fighting. About 2 inches.
It's about 2 inches. You know, there was a measurement earlier, you guys, when we were writing the facts down, and it was in metric, and I absolutely put it.
Converted it?
I converted it, because I was like, most of our listeners are American. No one's going to know, because we are so lazy. We speak English, and that's it, and we don't do metric.
Right.
Terrible. All right. So anyways, so the prosecution dropped these charges due to their determination that there was no reasonable probability of conviction. He became eligible for parole in February 2018. And on October 17th, 2018, Paul Bernardo was denied day and full parole by the Parole Board of Canada, and he remains incarcerated to this day. Carla was released from prison in 2005, and she married the brother of her lawyer.
Christ on a cracker.
And that is the story. I know, that's the story of Paul Bernardo and Carla Homolka, the Ken and Barbie killers. Are there any other thoughts, guys, that you want to contribute to this? Because this was truly awful.
Well, I'm pissed.
Yeah.
I'm pretty pissed. And I just want to say that I wish that all of the evidence, the video evidence, had been entered properly. I wish that that was not in honestly, for me, that's like a real thorn in my side, because mm-hmm. I think that Carla would have gotten an appropriate sentencing. That's just my two cents. And also, then fast forward to like, because Paul did what he did and like was into her sister as well as her, then she was just like, I'm going to marry my lawyer's brother. Mm-hmm. And that's how it feels to me. And I'm just like, sort of like, she is as bad as as Paul, i.e. Ken. So like Ken and Barbie, this is not the dream home. Okay, you guys, nobody gets a Barbie dream house. And I'm pissed. And that's my two cents. Let me ask you this, if I may. I want to know when you learned about this case and why it was so, or when you learned about this particular, you know, moment in time, this horrible person in your, you know, history of life, and why it has struck such a chord with you, as it has with many, because this is absolutely outrageous. But as we keep speaking about this and you know, they're racking up all of these women, was this a story that was told to you as a oh my God, be very careful type of thing? Or
yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, without being without all the trigger warnings of it all, like my parents were saying to me and to my sisters, there are three of us. When we were, I mean, he did this to people 14 to 23.
Right.
So when I was, you know, when I was like 16, my parents were like, don't, this has happened in the past. Obviously, the other thing that's so relevant to the story is you don't think anything bad's going to happen to you. This happens other places. This is in Canada. Everyone is kind and lovely. And we ride polar bears to school and things like that. You don't expect a terrible, terrible thing to happen. And I think it wasn't for shock value. My parents and our teachers told us it was just to be like, yes, bad things can happen.
It's a cautionary moment. It's a cautionary, you know, don't make these mistakes that, you know, that these young girls had no idea was happening, you know?
Because they didn't make any mistakes. They just didn't know.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. That's a great way of putting it. Mm-hmm.
One of the things I have to ask you ladies too, as far as my thoughts. Now, we did a case involving Pamela Smart, who got a life sentence for, you know, being an accomplice to first degree murder, essentially, and allegedly setting up this murder of her husband, a hit on her husband, so to speak. But this case is an example to me, I would argue, where the prosecution said they would not have agreed to a plea bargain had they known of the tapes. And that's such an unfortunate thing in time, right? You can't take that back. And I'm sure they just hate it as much as we do. I'm sure they do. But I also wonder how much of it is that white woman privilege that we've talked about so much this year of like, oh, that white girl's not going to get a ticket from that officer. You know, like I wonder, I mean, I don't know. I'm completely speculating. I'm spitballing. But, you know, but you know, like the way, and because she got ahead of it, because, you know, Paul's probably major mistake was turning on his wife and beating her, because she probably would have stayed with him much longer. But the fact of the matter is, December 27th, late December of 92, he beats her. And by February, you know, she's talking to the police. So I just, it just gives me pause that she got ahead of it. And so in real time, they're like, oh, she's the victim. And so that was the story, but she's hardly the victim, right? Give me your thoughts. Give me your thoughts. I'm just going off the weeds here.
No, I think she's definitely part of it. Yes, she is a victim of things in her life, but she took part in the actions. Like, that's her sister. Could you imagine being so obsessed with someone else's happiness that you think, you know what? I'm going to drug my sister and let you do whatever you want to her. That's insane. That's a that's a crazy person.
It's
like, that's mentally unstable.
My parents would have killed me. Like, they would actually have killed me. That's just, I know that to be a fact. If they had ever found out that I did that, which I would never do, but I'm just saying that my parents, instead of going like down like the denial river, thank you. My,
they would have been like,
parents would like, they'd be like, okay, you're bye. Thank you.
They'd be like that line from that movie, like, I gave you life, I'll take it away. You know, like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I put you in this world, I'll take you out.
Yeah. Something like that.
Wait, oh, can I tell you one more thing?
Yeah.
You must.
I've heard this story. I don't know how true this is. So please, I will research it and report back. But I was talking to my mom about this before I we did this. She said that Carla has another sister named Lori.
Yeah, the youngest
apparently,
one.
Apparently, mm-hmm. The youngest one, and she is living. And she is connected to, have you watched the documentary on Netflix called Don't Fuck with Cats?
Yeah.
Okay.
Apparently, she was called as a witness in his trial because he became so obsessed with the Paul Bernardo and Carla stuff that he like fascinated towards Lori, the younger sister. And apparently, he sent her a body part. So she was called to the trial, the murder trial of Luca Magnotta. Luca Magnotta was the guy that the murderer. He was called. She was called to the trial, and then she had no connection to it. But she had to be like, "I received this body part."
Oh my gosh! All because this guy apparently was obsessed with the story.
Jeez!
I know this poor family.
I don't like these poor people. I don't like it. I'm not into that.
No,
that's not for me.
But I am into Danny Waite. We love you so much. Thank you so much for giving us some precious time. It's so nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
You have been integral to the telling of this story in every way. And we are very effing grateful for that. And so is my
dog. I'm very grateful for both of you and your podcast. It's so, so nice in quarantine to have your friends talk to you. Even
about
if it's terrible about
terrible things.
Yeah, terrible things. I was going to say, and give you nightmares. But, you know, we're here.
Yes.
We are here for you. We're here for all of you. But we are the most thankful that you joined us today.
Goodbye, girl.
Bye. Goodbye.
Love See you over the rainbow.
Oh, gosh.
Where on the Danny? Okay, that's creepy. Somewhere over the Danny? No.
Ooh.
Ew. Sorry.
Well I'm going to go. Thank you so much.
Okay. It's, now
goodbye.
It's
bye. She's the kindest human being.
What a thrill.
I love her. Yeah.
What a thrill. And, you know, I always love when we have, like, the kindest of humans on to discuss this is one of the most insane ones, to be honest, and I'm just going to say that out loud because it really, as I've mentioned 62 times, it really trapped my ass. And so to have somebody like Danny, Dr. D, who's so lovely in every way, and she finds the good. It's a great balance to someone like me who can't find the good in this
You're
particular
a liar.
Case.
No, you can find the good.
Not in this case.
Oh,
not in this case.
I'm sorry for calling you a liar.
I can't do it in this case.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. I take it on. I don't ever. Yeah. And I apologize too for apologizing. So.
Well.
And there you have it. There you have it, true crime fam. You know, we adore you. We love you. We'd marry you on a good day and a bad day. And we thank you so much for listening. Until next time, keep killing it.
Don't kill anyone.
Killers, go to our Patreon page and join us to get exclusive bonus content and follow us on Instagram at Killing It On Broadway and Twitter at Killing It On B-Way.
Subscribe to us for free wherever you download your podcasts.
And go ahead and give us a 5-star rating and a lovely review. It'll be good for you.
Killing It On Broadway is a production of Killing It On Broadway LLC.
Music by Mary Mitchell Campbell. Orchestrations, Benedict Braxton Smith.
Edited and engineered by Smokey.
Morale officers, Fred and Nelson. Say goodbye, Fred.
Say goodbye, Nelson.